Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Of course, yesterday was the 21st anniversary of 9/11, and this was the scene at MetLife Stadium in New York where the Jets played. The national anthem, started by a member of NYPD and joined in by the entire crowd. Kneel to this version of the anthem, I dare you. No BLM bull jive, no kneeling, big American flag covering the field, as was the want of within the NFL before it decided to throw in with the new Marxists.
Certain stadiums had the full flag. Others just had, you know, the regular flag.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Kneel to that. So a bit of a remembrance. I don't take much in terms of that being anything other than a fleeting unifying moment, but we'll take what we can get.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And so it brings to mind the question of what people remember from 9/11, whether we should continue to remember it or just move on. This is particularly salient for young people.
Yesterday, day three after Queen Elizabeth died, every network, including 60 Minutes, led with the death of the Queen before going to remembering 21 years. And I found that appalling. And just, you know, I felt like as if we're putting September 11th in our back pocket. But when they did cover it, this is just, you know, every year people read the names of loved ones who died, and it still affects the people who lost loved ones.
Maria, I don't know when this weight in my chest is going to go away, but it's going to be there, I guess, until they lay me down beside you.
Uncle Jimmy, I'm so proud to be named after you. You're my hero.
Nino, one thing I'm sure, I was there from day one. Looking for you from the first hour I received the phone call. Thanks to you, you love me.
So the question prompted by this interview that was done by our friends over at Campus Beat, Campus Reform news, campusreform.org. Should we just move on? And as I was saying, it's particularly salient for young people who either were not alive or were too young to appreciate what was happening. And you think about this, Bernie Kerik was on over the weekend talking about how 9/11 isn't required instruction in K through 12 schools, and it should be. You have Frank Siller, who lost his brother, who was one of the firefighters, died on 9/11. He started Tunnel to Towers, and that in, what Tunnel to Towers does includes educating children. It's a curriculum piece, educating children about 9/11, the context and the questions. Hopefully it's dynamic and it continues to grow as we get further and further away from 9/11 and we add additional context to what happened on that day and how it inexorably changed the trajectory of the United States. So here's the Q&A from our friends at Campus Reform, their Campus Beat segment. They went to the University of Pittsburgh to ask the question, is it time to just move on beyond 9/11? And pay particular note to how those young people at the University of Pittsburgh who do understand 9/11, who do have some familiarity with it, how they recall it, what they took away from the instruction, however limited they received at the K through 12 level.
Do you know what the last major terrorist attack on U.S. soil was?
I actually do not. I want to say 9/11, but I feel like that's old.
I'm going to say 9/11.
I have no clue.
No, I don't.
It wouldn't be a shooting. No. Then no.
Uvalde, Texas. I would consider that terrorism.
9/11?
Wait, 9/11?
9/11. Did you remember learning about 9/11 in school?
Very briefly, like at the end of my AP Gov class.
It was never something that anyone in my academic history like kind of ignored.
We watched videos mostly.
They did actually do a section on like Islamophobia as a result of 9/11.
Mainly videos, like documentaries, like textbook readings.
We learned about like personal feelings and personal connections to it.
In school, it was just that day for the most part.
My teacher mainly told his like personal story, like because we were talking about like COVID.
They were pretty solemn about it and made it like a really big deal because I wasn't even born.
So in the past years, we've kind of seen a push from higher education to move on from 9/11. For example, there was an editorial that was released by Penn State University Barron's campus saying that Americans kind of obsess over 9/11. Do you agree with the idea that we should move on from 9/11?
I think it's an important part of history, so, like, no, it's fine. It's not a big, huge thing I've ever learned. It's been, like, a day lesson.
A lot of people died. You know, that sucks. I think that, you know, they should be told that.
I think it's important to tell, like, what actually happened and explain maybe that, like, Islam wasn't the reason that that happened.
The victors write the history books, and I think that's kind of wrong because it doesn't paint the full picture. The terrorists would be villainized, but there's obviously a reason why they went to crash planes into the Twin Towers.
I don't think anything should be omitted from it.
Maybe we could start to move away from it a little bit. In general, I think it will fade away.
One of the main critiques I have of the whole, you know, specter of 9/11, it's sort of portrayed as like, oh, we're just the victims, you know, and this, you know, this happened out of nowhere. It's used to completely vilify, you know, Middle Eastern people especially.
We don't learn about history, we repeat it. So just being aware of these things.
Would you kind of agree with the sentiment then that it might be time to move on?
I do think it's like kind of insane how much TSA we have to go through just to like go like fly. 9/11 kind of like probably instilled fear in a lot of people. Like people my age weren't there for it, so it's kind of like, oh, like what was the big deal?
I don't mean this in like an American exceptionalism way, but I think it was, you know, pretty important
because there's such a focus on it. There is a lot of like Islamophobia.
I don't think necessarily move on, but definitely like the things that come with it, like Islamophobia. I think it still needs to be talked about, but definitely in like a less racist way.
I don't think that tragedy is something that should be moved along from. It's not something that should be forgotten or dismissed.
I think it's kind of time to move on. We can't obsess over it.
How are we doing transmitting our values? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. How are we doing in maintaining that generational compact between our posterity and our offspring? How encouraged are you from those responses from University of Pittsburgh undergrads, which I suggest is probably center cut for college students in America today?
I mean, the part where they said, you know, it was a personal, it's about feelings.
Personal
like,
feelings.
Where were you when it happened,
exactly.
But not about the actual events.
Yeah, exactly.
And then comparing it during COVID. Yeah, you know, because things the world changed during after 9/11, and the world changed after COVID.
Yeah, the personal feelings—that's one thing, right? It's just about where you were when this happened, and then of course you hear many students mention Islamophobia. That the real takeaway from 9/11 was America's reaction to it, and the assertion that Muslims or Middle Eastern people were somehow.
All vilified.
Targeted or, yeah, vilified, and that's just not the case. But that was a lot of the media reporting. It's a good piece over at American Mind from Alexander Riley, who's a sociology professor at Bucknell. And he has a couple of important points here. One is the importance of 9/11, why we shouldn't move on from it. He writes that... the importance of the day, not only in its human material cost, but also what it represented as a contribution to the American civil religion. Core aspects of traditional American national identity. Masculine heroism, a democratic citizenry prepared to stand in its defense, the deeply spiritual values that were present at the country's origin, were all displayed on that day. I believed our collective memory of the response to terror by heroic co-citizens would be sustained in our culture and perhaps even point the way to a return to previous unity. The truth is, the farther we get from that date, the more evident becomes that unifying the country is likely an impossible mission. He recalls, you know, to make it personal, when the planes hit the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And the Pentagon. I was just at the start of my second year as assistant professor at a liberal arts college in central Pennsylvania. He noted that he had already sort of seen what was going on in higher ed at the time, that the faculty in his own department and elsewhere were motivated by ideological agendas, not the pursuit of truth. The books they were selecting for their classes were typically from advocates and activists rather than scholars. And he notes the email that was posted in his department on September 12th of 2001. Message to the members of the department calling for peace and reconciliation with the people who had carried out the attacks, stating our violent history was the cause of the retributive strikes against us and we deserved this counterblow. This person who posted the email, asserted the best thing we could do was come to a collective reckoning with our own malevolent role in world affairs and to spend any resources we had on the poor populations of the countries from which the terrorists had sprung, from which they always invariably spring. In the moment of the country's greatest tragedy in at least a half a century, they leapt up not to defend it, but to denounce it. 21 years later, the divide has only widened and deepened. Yeah. In case you forget what the response was from certain quarters, that's exactly what it was, to denounce the country and rationalize the terrorist attack that occurred here. And that should have been your first indication about how many people in this country who've lived incredibly privileged lives thanks to the opportunity provided in this country loathe this country. And where you find those people in all of the institutions we're now discussing on a daily basis that have lost their legitimacy. Why? Because they're populated by the kind of people that were at this liberal arts college that Alexander Riley taught at back at the time of 9/11, and frankly at Bucknell where he teaches now and in higher ed generally, and across all of the civic institutions in this country. That's some additional context to 9/11 that shouldn't be forgotten as we're remembering that day and what has transpired in now the 21 years since.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to what's going on in the Miami-Dade School District. It's a really interesting case study. It's sort of becoming the 2022 Fairfax or Loudoun County School District that led up to Youngkin's election in Virginia. But first, quickly, we were talking about the 21st anniversary of 9/11 yesterday before the news break. Bob in Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for getting to me and talking about 9/11 and the collapse of the towers and the attack. But watching the newscast this weekend, I didn't see any mention of the 10th anniversary of another terrorist attack. Have we already forgotten about Benghazi and the death of Craig Stevens, the ambassador?
Christopher Stevens.
It's just amazing. That's another major attack. Oh, I forgot. What difference does it make?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bob. Chris Stevens, Sean Smith, Glenn Doherty, Tyrone Woods, memorialized very well in that movie 13 Hours, if you haven't seen it.
Oh, it's a great movie.
Yeah. Well, so that's a good call. Thanks for that reminder, Bob. You're right. We'd be remiss if we didn't remember the 10th anniversary of Benghazi as well. Miami-Dade School Board flipped this past election because Ron DeSantis backed a bunch of school board candidates. And this school board, Miami-Dade, which is a big urban school district, which is in part why it's interesting, is now very different than it was before the so-called Don't Say Gay, which means don't sexualize children with graphic content as part of your curriculum in K through 3. That's what the law actually is.
That's all they're asking. They don't need to learn about sex or anal sex or anything.
It has nothing to do with saying or not saying gay, but that's how it's been characterized. There was this fight about LGBTQ History Month at their board meeting last week. To recognize October, upcoming month, as LGBTQ History Month. And the question is whether or not that violates the state's parental rights and education law. Listen to the testimony from one individual in particular at the board meeting. I thought Jordan's offering was particularly on point. Jordan apparently is affiliated with the Gays Against Groomers group.
Oh, I like that. You should follow them on Twitter. They're good.
That has been on again, off again on Twitter, right, because of bans, you know, because they're not following the orthodoxy of the Lavender Bund. Jordan from Gays Against Groomers testifying to the public comment section. Miami-Dade School Board on this idea of LGBTQ History Month in October.
Good evening. Thank you, everyone, for this opportunity to speak tonight. I'm here today because I am concerned about the current and future state of our education system. I am a Miami native and a product of the MDCPS system. I'm also a gay man, and as a gay man, I understand the importance of a healthy and balanced education. I understand the importance in diversity of thought, and ultimately, I understand the importance of unbiased development. What is happening right now is no longer acceptance. It's no longer the support my community needed in the 90s and early 2000s. It's indoctrination. I do not use the word lightly, but it's the truth. The children deserve an education that will develop them, give them a platform for critical thinking and problem solving so that we can push and create a better future. What we are pushing right now is not that. We are moving in a direction that will create entitled, confused, depressed, and potentially dangerous adults. Providing support and being accepting is very different from promoting and encouraging a certain lifestyle. Growing up, I had people who supported me and loved me unconditionally. I also had people who disagreed with me and maybe disliked me because of my sexuality. Not only was that okay, but it was vital to my development. Not only I learned how to interact and find common ground with anyone and everyone, I learned that it's okay not to agree on everything. Legislation and policies do not encourage positive change. People do. If you feel LGBT youth need more support, support them yourself as an individual. There are plenty of private organizations that provide youth with things like counseling.
Please, please, let's not applause. Thank you.
Counseling, community, and financial help are available to LGBT youth. Parents must be in 100% control of their child's development and education. The education system has been hijacked by people who push their agendas disguised as social justice warriors. I am gay. I am not oppressed. I am not being attacked. I'm not abused. Please treat me the same as everyone else. I remember when we were fighting to be equal, and now we're fighting to have an entire month celebrating my sexuality and parades. I don't need that. I really don't. That is exclusivity. That is not inclusivity. I don't want to be excluded. So please, treat me the same as everyone else. Okay? One day I will have children, and they will definitely not be attending a public school, and I'm going to work my butt off so that I can put them in a very nice school.
Last year, the resolution for LGBTQ History Month passed by a 7-1 resolution, by a 7-1 vote on the resolution. Last week, it went down by that margin. So don't tell me that the parental revolt isn't real. Don't tell me that you can't gain control of your school board and thus some semblance of control over your kid's education, because it's happening. It's happened in Miami-Dade. May not be on every issue. May not be in every school district. But Miami-Dade is yet another example where overreach by a hyper-politicized school board has led to a revolt and a restoration of some common sense and decency with respect to discussions and policymaking, which is all I understand most parents are asking for. Doesn't seem like too much. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, DA, turnkey.pro text line. After we get through November 8th, all those local elections, you roll right into them next year. We've talked a lot about Chicago mayor and the primary in February, but there's municipal elections everywhere, including for school board, come April of next year. Why can't you do in places like Naperville or Algonquin or Northbrook what has been done in Miami-Dade? I don't see any reason why. And what's at stake? Well, this is what's at stake. Not just something like LGBTQ History Month. This is what's at stake, because this is who is in the classroom. Not everywhere, not even a majority, but enough that it's indicative of what's happening in K-12 education. It's exactly what that gentleman just said. Pride is not indoctrination. What's going on here is not tolerance. It's not inclusivity. It's exclusivity. It's intolerance. It's groupthink. And it's worse than that, as we have provided example over example in the last, couple of years, that here's the next frontier. The next frontier that's coming.
What?
Is to
moms being able to marry their sons.
Is to mainline pedophilia.
Oh.
And it's not pedophilia because we don't call them pedophiles anymore, which is an indication of the truth of what we're saying. What do we call them?
People who...
MAPS.
MAPS.
Minor attracted people. Here's an English teacher who is now on administrative leave at Franklin High School in El Paso.
I know that high school.
I was calling them that. You're not allowed to label people like that. What? Stop it, Diego.
Yeah, no,
we're not going to call them that. We're going to call them MAPS.
No.
Minor attracted persons. No. So don't judge people just because they want to have sex with a five-year-old. Oh.
Don't judge people just because they want to have sex with a five-year-old.
It's sickening. The teacher is on leave, right?
Yeah, on leave. Right.
But the fact that they think that way and was hired in the first place is pretty scary.
She's on leave because somebody recorded what she said.
Right. If there wasn't a recording, she'd still be there teaching your children.
How is it that you don't know one of your English teachers has this sort of ideology that she brings to the classroom? Do you think that was the first instance she said something like this? I doubt it.
Can you play that again in case people missed it?
Stop calling them that. You're not allowed to label people like that. What? Stop it, Diego.
Yeah,
we're not going to call them that. We're going to call them MAPS.
No.
Minor attracted persons.
No.
So don't judge people just because they want to have sex with a five-year-old.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Don't judge people because they want to have sex with a five-year-old.
Disney, Pizza Hut, and the AFT, interesting troika, just a few other organizations, few of the organizations in partnership with First Book, a nonprofit that describes itself as an innovative leader in education equity. Uh-oh.
There's that word again.
The organization is making low-cost, sexually explicit books available to K-12 teachers with affiliations like Randy Weingarten's AFT, and you heard what Randy said last week. You know, it's
hard pushing.
These politicians are forcing teachers to be political. They don't want to be political. Right. First Book offers discounts to teachers with titles such as Who is RuPaul? And Fred Gets Dressed.
And they're learning that instead of learning about 9/11.
It Feels Good to Be Yourself, a book about gender identity, and other of its titles. These deeply discounted books, like Fred Gets Dressed, recommended for children ages 4 to 6. What's in Fred Gets Dressed? I'm glad you asked. The boy loves to be naked. He romps around the house naked and wild and free until he romps into his parents' closet and is inspired to get dressed. First, he tries on his dad's clothes, but they don't fit well.
Yeah, and then, let me guess, stiletto heels.
And then he tries his mom's clothes, and wow, boy, the boy looks great.
A lot of kids try on their
The boy continues with the boy trying on his mother's jewelry and makeup. Once discovered by his parents, they all get dressed together.
Oh, what? Awkward moments? Okay.
Other books offered by First Books include The Pronoun Book and Flamer. Flamer is a graphic novel that Fox News has reported on that contains sexually charged topics and imagery, well, like genderqueer does. We've talked about before. It's in a lot of the books. So this is what's actually happening. This is what's actually being said and done, which is why if you're willing to confront what is and not just turn your eye away from something that is uncomfortable and difficult to believe, yet it's true, this is what's happening, then you can pull off something like the parents, with a little air support from DeSantis, were able to pull off in Miami-Dade. Brian in St. John, Indiana.
Hey, good morning, guys. Happy Monday. Recently, I found some books at my Lake County Public Library called First Conversation, and it's all tied back to Lindsay Amir and her queerkidsstuff.com. And one of them is by Megan Madison and Jessica Kelly, and one of them is about race, and one of them is about gender, and there's a series of 8 books. The race one is very clear that white people are racist and nobody else is, and the gender one, you know, normalizes the use of men using women's bathrooms, and the books are for 2 to 5-year-olds. So pay attention to your libraries, guys. That's all I got. Bye.
Thanks, Brian. Jim, Tampa, Florida.
Hey, good morning, you guys. This is such an important issue. I've just finished 40 years of teaching, 20 in a public, 20 in a Catholic school. This is the prime cultural battlefield in America, the elementary school classroom and campus. And the thing is, we don't have anybody fighting on that battlefield. One thing Randy Weingarten did say, there are teachers that are conservative, but they just don't know what to do, and they're frightened for their jobs. But we have to get in there and fight on that battlefield, and teachers don't really know how to do it. That's the thing. We need professional development for our side. That's something important, and a lot of it has to do with coaches, too. Amy's, the job she does with her players, that's really important. PE teachers are important. The universal principles that make up the country, that's what we need to teach, and it isn't getting taught. But it is not media, not university, not the military, not politics. It's the elementary school classroom and campus.
Thanks, Jim.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've got people talking about the Orwellian named Safety Act in Illinois. This is the no cash bail, defenestrate the police, don't prosecute anybody law that was, legislation that was signed into law by Governor Spaulding.
And you know who's talking about it right now? High schoolers. I can't believe everybody knows about it because I said, well, what's going on? They said, oh, now it's on the Instagram. So, or what the Instagram and Snapchat, and they're passing this. You know, the still screen of what, you know, if you commit what crime, you can get out, like arson, burglary, second-degree murder. And they're engaged, so this is good.
No bail for, a series of violent offenses, including but not limited to some of what you just mentioned. And, yes, that I've seen that being distributed, which is good. Keith Peekow is the mayor of Orland Park. He's also a candidate for Congress. He's running against Sean Casson in the suburbs. He understands what time it is as it pertains to his concerns for the village he currently represents as mayor, Orland Park, and what the Safety Act would mean for his community.
As of January 1st, 2023, the following things will go into effect, and people need to be aware of this. It abolishes cash bail for almost every offense. This includes, but isn't limited to, kidnapping, armed robbery, second-degree murder, drug-induced homicide, aggravated DUI, threatening a public official, and aggravated fleeing and eluding. Offenders released on electronic monitoring have to be in violation for 48 hours before law enforcement can act. They could almost drive to Alaska before we can even look for them. It denies victims their constitutional rights. And keep this in mind, businesses and homeowners. Officers will no longer be able to remove trespassers from your residence or your businesses. Someone could decide to live in your shed, and all we can do is give them a ticket. You have to decide what level of force is required to remove them and whether or not it's legal. This is a massive threat to the residents of Orland Park, Cook County, and Illinois.
I thought the emergency test messaging as the underbed there, as the bed for the remarks was nice, nice touch. But, yeah, that trespassing example he gave, by the way, businesses and residents, is absolutely true.
Yeah, they can live on your property or in your business or outside of your business, and you can't, if you call the police, all they'll do is be able to give them a ticket, and that's it.
Much more on this is coming, but just again, to try to drive this point home, to make it real, getting beyond statistics, just sort of real world implications. We've got number 36, according to CWB Chicago. 36 person accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony this year. These alleged crimes involve at least 70 victims, 17 of whom have died. In other words, there are 70 additional victims, 17 people who are dead, who wouldn't be, who shouldn't be, if people who had been charged with felonies were not no cash or, in Cook County's case, very low cash bailed out, as number 36 was, for engaging in a rolling gun battle 3 years ago.
We say these numbers, but there's a person linked to every single number here. 17 people are dead that should not be dead. And so I think Kim Fox has blood on her hands, and then they're just going to exacerbate it by this safety act.
Kim Fox, Lori Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker, anybody who supports essentially making what de facto has been the situation under Fox and Lightfoot in Cook County, scaling that, making that the law of the state, which is exactly what the Safety Act does. For more on this and a couple of other issues, pleased to be joined again by Tom DeVore. He's the Republican nominee for Attorney General Illinois. More information on his candidacy and campaign, TomDeVore.com. Tom, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Hello, Amy.
We talked a bit about this last week when you were on, and we want to get to some other issues you've taken a position on recently that are intriguing. But just the commentary on this, the Safety Act, what your perspective is, what you would intend to do if, as Attorney General, if this were to go into effect January 1, given what you're hearing from prosecutors as well as mayors like Keith Pico.
It's the biggest conversation in the state right now, Dan, by far. I mean, I'm north to south all the time, and when you guys were talking about it, about even the kids are talking about it, it's unbelievable. I don't know how it got their attention as fast as it did, but I'm certainly pleased. But every prosecutor, sheriff that I talk to across the state is just, they're besides themselves on how they're going to deal with this. We're going to have a mass exodus of alleged criminals that are going to be on the streets January 1st. That's a part of the conversation that doesn't happen much. But, you know, they're not sure what to do. It's almost like everybody's in a frenzy. And, you know, what the Attorney General can do, assuming that we have a new Attorney General, you know, legislature passes it. So just come in and disregard it or you know, try to work around it somehow. I don't know how appropriate that is, but hoping the discretion of the state's attorneys and the judges across the state have a significant impact. I'm hopeful for that. But certainly the Attorney General's office needs to be working with the legislature to wipe out this stuff.
Or perhaps prosecutors, if county prosecutors make a claim that this legislation is unconstitutional, at least in part.
That conversation can be had, certainly. We've had that a little bit. We're just not talking about it, but it's you know, it's one of those things that it sneaks up on the people. Dan, you talk about it a lot, and it's one of my main messages. These things sneak up on us when we're not paying attention. And this is just a significant example of one of those things.
Well, Governor Pritzker, we were there when he signed it, and he even said that this is a work in progress, and that changes could still be made. But then you talk to people like, you know, Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown, who said, "Yeah, well, we're hoping that this doesn't happen." Well, there's got to be a meeting or something has to happen because, as you mentioned, people are just waiting to see. But we need people to be proactive and change what this is. Is Governor Pritzker, any state reps, are they doing anything right now to change it?
Not to my knowledge. And, you know, it's one of those realities, Amy, of of we as the people of our state and even our nation, but we're talking about our state, we think that our elected leaders are more prescient and have wisdom that they don't have any more or less than everyday people. So I guarantee you there was a pretty much a Nancy Pelosi moment here where we got to pass this so we can see what's in it and didn't realize what they were doing. And now they're all paralyzed with looking like a bunch of fools. I'll use that word. Looking yes. like a bunch of fools, and so they're paralyzed. That's what I think.
Yeah. And they're all up for re-election, too.
That's exactly what it is, that they've been exposed, and now they're looking for ways to direct people's attention away from this. They don't want to talk about the merits of it. So, you know, they need to create boogeymen like me and other people to say that you're racist or you're this or you're that, because they can't talk about the substance of this, including the process by which it was passed. There's a good editorial from the Chicago Tribune, actually, back when it was under the stewardship of Kristen McQuarrie, the editorial board there, and comparing what New Jersey did versus what Illinois did. Boy, when New Jersey is a model for good government for you, then you know how far you've fallen. But the Tribune editorial goes like this. When public officials in New Jersey began exploring eliminating cash bail in that state's criminal justice system, the governor, lawmakers, prosecutors, and public defenders spent years hashing out a bill with the legislature. When it finally passed, there was no surprise factor. Not so in Illinois, where a controversial sweeping criminal justice reform bill, more than 700 pages in length, eliminating cash bail was just one piece, flew through the House and Senate during a lame duck session. The Senate voted on the bill in the middle of the night. House Democrats cut off questions from Republicans minutes before new General Assembly was sworn in. This is back from January of 2021, and we have the roll call, which is basically a party line vote. But just the difference between Illinois ramming this through because it was the pet project of the Black Caucus and Governor Pritzker was going to do their bidding versus what even New Jersey did, a Democrat state like New Jersey did.
You're right, Dan, and that's another conversation that we can save for a later day. But those rules that you're talking about on how this legislation was passed, which is not extraordinary. It happens with a lot of legislation in Illinois. I think there's a significant due process violation for the people of this state in the way that legislation is crafted, presented, rammed through in the middle of the night without giving a meaningful opportunity for the public to participate. I think there's constitutional problems with that as well.
Now, this other issue that you put a statement out of on Friday, that is, this issue of J.B. Pritzker paying state employees more than their state set salary, $1.5 million a year to top 15 employees in his administration, he's giving them out of his own pocket. Bruce Rauner did something like this as well. And I always found this a bit questionable because state employees work for the people because that's who pays their salaries. But when you're at the when you're getting an enhancement from the particular individual in state government you work for, then you prioritize that particular individual over your responsibilities to the Constitution and to the rule of law in the state. And certainly it calls that into question. And you think that this $1.5 million a year that Pritzker is paying out to his top 15 employees could be violative of state law.
Absolutely do, and I would say this to you, Dan. When the narrative that you just gave, I would respectfully suggest to you that it's following along with the narrative that Pritzker and the Democrats have put forth. He's not giving anyone any salary supplements. He's giving them a gift. And when I break this down for you, you can go into what gift, you can look at the IRS code, etc. But anytime you give someone something, money, etc., without expecting anything back from them in equal return, that's a gift. So when J.B. Pritzker, directly or indirectly, gives money to these people, that private transfer to them of money, there's nothing given in exchange for that. He can put a label on it of whatever he wants. Oh, they don't make enough money, I'm giving them more money. That has nothing to do with his private interests. So it's not a supplement of salary. That is a red herring that they've created. It's an absolute transfer of money to these state employees from a private individual in exchange for nothing. And the fact that he's the governor is irrelevant. This is a private citizen, a private entity, gifting money
to state employees. It's an absolute gift, so that next step is whether he's a prohibited source or not. But again, our people of the state should quit calling it a supplement of salary. It's not. It's the legislature, the people define how much money our state employees get paid for the services they provide. We deem what's adequate. That's what they get paid. He's gifting them money, and we get to the prohibited source in a second. But whether it's a prohibited source or not is the only question.
So then if it's a prohibited source, if that determination is made, then it's a violation of the state's gift ban act.
Exactly. What if J.B. Pritzker decided, well, I don't think the legislators make enough money, so I'm going to supplement their salaries?
Right.
Starts getting. What if ComEd says, I don't think that these 15 administrative officials of Governor Pritzker, I don't think they make enough money, I'm going to supplement their salary. It starts becoming more glaring. So the fact that he's the governor, take it out of the question. This private organization of the governors that he controls is giving them money for nothing.
Oh, and car rides and clothes. Yeah, I mean, and that's why they are so rude to certain members of the media that they don't like, because they don't work for us. They work for JB, and they'll protect him at any cost.
Well, think about, and I'll use Andy Marr as an example, and I'm not being on Andy in particular, we don't see anything the same. You know, he was a legislator. Before that, I think he was a teacher. He gets appointed to work for the governor at $120-some thousand a year. The legislature and the people said is adequate for your services. And then it gets deviled pretty much by Pritzker's private resources. I mean, that, to me, that is glaring. It's a gift. And again, we'll get to the prohibited source conversation in a second. But it just reeks of impropriety, that's for certain. And moreover, again, it's a violation of the Gift Ban Act, in my opinion.
So let's get to the prohibited source question, and you know, you continue to use former State Senator Andy Menar as the deputy governor as the example, or what have you. But you know, the argument then maybe is, well, wait a second, these employees are under the charge of the governor, so it doesn't present the sort of same concerns as the governor providing more money to state legislators personally for their salaries. You know, that crosses the line of executive to legislative branch and so forth. So since these employees are under his charge, he's not a prohibited source.
Well, I understand the analogy that we're comparing is two different fact patterns, but keeping in mind the Gift Ban Act is about not actually necessarily prohibiting impropriety, but taking the appearance of impropriety away. So if you look at the statute, a prohibited source is really subjected to four different types of criteria. One of them is the source, and again, the source is J.B. Pritzker, the source is not the governor, is J.B. Pritzker doing business or trying to do business with the state? Of course he does. He has billions of dollars of contracts with the state. And the analysis is not, well, okay, is the money that these people are getting, is it really causing any, you know, definitive impropriety? That's not the analysis of the law. J.B. Pritzker is doing business with the state. The second one of them that I think applies is, are J.B.'s interests? It says interests. That's a very broad term, which could be political interest, personal interest, financial interest. Are his interests substantially impacted by the performance of these employees? We could get all kinds of conversation point about that. Even his political interests are substantially impacted by these people. This loyalty thing that you're talking about, Dan, about, you know, them being loyal to him and not to the people, you can put that within the definition of a prohibited source, and it fits right in there.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. And so I saw from your release you're calling on the Office of the Executive Inspector General to open an investigation into the propriety of this. And you expect to hear back some indication on that this week?
I'm not sure, you know, because here's what has to happen at a minimum, in my opinion, from the Ethics Commission. There is no doubt, it is 100% unequivocal, that it's a gift to these individuals. There needs to be an explanation given to the people of this state on how J.B. Pritzker is not a prohibited source. That is the conversation. There has to be an explanation of it to the legislature, to everyone. He's not a prohibited source. And do that analysis and let us look at it and read it, and reasonable minds can have a conversation. In my opinion, from what I've looked at, there's a significant question and a significant argument that he is a prohibited source. If they want to try to argue that he's not, they need to lay it out to us how it's not. I mean, he has billions of dollars of contracts with the state that the governor's office or the administrative agencies control. He controls the administrative agencies. I want to hear them lay it out of not only is there a real conflict, is there even an appearance of a conflict? Because the law is intended to eliminate even these appearances because it causes our people to question the integrity of our government.
He is Tom DeVore, Republican nominee for Illinois Attorney General. Tom DeVore, D-E-V-O-R-E, TomDeVore.com for more info on his campaign. Tom, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Vice President Kamala Harris sat down with that yapping little terrier from Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, for an extended interview that was full of trivialities and disjointed nonsense, including on the border. Border security. We have a secure border, Mrs. Vice President?
Would you call the border secure?
I think that there is no question that we have to do what the President and I asked Congress to do. Is the first request we made, pass a bill to create a pathway to citizenship. The border is secure, but we also have a broken immigration system, in particular over the last 4 years before we came in. And it needs to be fixed.
We're going to have 2 million people cross this border for the first time ever. You're confident this border is secure?
We have a secure border in that that is a priority for any nation, including ours and our administration. But there are still a lot of problems that we are trying to fix, given the deterioration that happened over the last 4 years.
I don't even know what any of that means.
I don't think she does either.
This paper I'm reading from says the border is secure, so that's what I'm going with. Okay, 2 million illegal crossings since Biden and Harris came to office. That's secure, according to them. Myra Flores, who's a newly minted congressperson on the border, representing communities on the border, she had a little bit of a different perspective on it, someone who lives near the border and represents people who do. This is what she had to say to Maria Bartiromo.
And this is not a humanitarian crisis. This is a national security crisis. And today we must remember that there is people still out there wanting to hurt Americans, and that is why border security is so important. Well, first of all, Vice President Kamala Harris has done nothing for us in South Texas to secure the borders. She's useless. And at this point, you know, I'd rather her not come to South Texas just because she's going to be in the way of our Border Patrol agents processing the women and children that have been raped. I'd rather her stay away because unless she's going to come here to South Texas for real solutions, I don't want her here.
Mm. Well, if that's the...
She wouldn't...
That's the threshold, then she's not going to be able to clear that.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the implications of the lack of border security, despite what VP Harris said, are being felt not just on border states anymore, but in part because of Texas Governor Greg Abbott's decision to force the nation to pay attention to what's happening on the border by shipping some who come across to Washington, D.C., to New York, and to Chicago. This is being forced upon us to focus in on what's happening on the border and have a little bit of a conversation about it, particularly as sanctuary cities that turned Illinois into sanctuary states, as we have in Illinois, ultimately visit these problems on suburban communities, as we've seen over the last week, first in Burr Ridge and now in Elk Grove Village.
And they came, 90 people, and trying to figure it all out was Mayor Craig Johnson, who was at the outside of the hotel when the immigrants arrived.
We started doing some homework. The state of Texas has no clue where Elk Grove Village is. They were not going to Elk Grove Village, they were going to the city of Chicago. She wants to proudly say politically, I'm a sanctuary city, I welcome you open arms, but when reality checks and five busloads shows up in her city, she can't handle them. So let's give them to Elk Grove Village. That's wrong.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid mayor of Elk Grove Village, Craig Johnson. Craig, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Amy, good to be on.
So, obviously the whole region heard what you had to say over the weekend in response to this development, but just give us the timeline on what happened when you heard that some busloads of folks were going to be delivered to, I guess, the La Quinta Inn in Elk Grove Village, and you know, give us from beginning of understanding what was happening to then your response.
Well, lots happened over the weekend. A lot has changed over the weekend, but go as concise I can for you folks. About 1:30 on Friday, we received calls from a young lady named Jennifer from the governor's office trying to reach out to us, finally made connection around 2, and we were told that there's going to be a busload of migrants coming to Elk Grove. So, of course, we asked how many. We don't know. Where are they going? We don't know. What time are they going to get there? We don't know. So we said, well, it would be helpful if we had this information because we've got some questions we want addressed just for the community safety and, you know, well-being. And that is, one, what kind of background checks have been done for security with them and what kind of health screens have been done. I understand the federal government has deemed them to be legal, which it's out of my purview, and I have to accept that. And being legal, there's limited things we can do. But I am sworn to protect the health, safety, and welfare of my community, and I need those questions answered so that I can rest assured my community that they're fine to be here. Well, about 5 o'clock, we still hadn't gotten any answers, and so I pretty much said, talking to state people again, that, well, once the bus arrives, whatever time it is, our police officers will be there. We will stop the people from deporting the bus. They have to stay on the bus. We'll give them water. Matter of fact, there's a McDonald's across the street. I said, I will personally go buy an eat meal. We'll feed them. And until I get those questions answered, I just want to know the safety background, health background. I can't let them in my community. I've got to protect my community. I've got to protect everyone involved. Well, about 5:45, 5:50, I got another call back saying that two things. One, they're going to keep them in Chicago for the night at the county health area. And two, they're going to have a conference call for me at about 7:30 Friday night with people from the federal government, the Homeland Security, FEMA, other officials, and Alicia, who's the head of Illinois Homeland Security. At 7:30, to their credit, they gave me all the time and very thorough, full knowledge of the screening they go through, a biometric security screening, very intense, very deep, and also health screenings where they check for monkeypox, COVID, and other ailments that they have. Now, that's in El Paso. Then when they arrive in Chicago, they go through a second health screening through Cook County Department of Health. That alleviated our concerns as far as those subjects go. So we said, okay, we're fine for them to come. They can go to the hotel, and those issues no longer exist for us. We feel confident that the safety of this community is well protected. And so, and again, I know all the other peripheral things going on, the battles, all that. I do think this thing, though, these are human beings. These are people. These are, you know, we got to treat them with the dignity. And since they're technically legally allowed to be here based on the president's order, you know, they technically have a right to be here. So with those assurances passed, they came in on Saturday morning. Now, we were told originally there's going to be families and young children and all that, which I'm a grandfather of 8 with a 9th one out of the way. I care very much about children. But when they did arrive, it was not children. We saw nothing but single male between the 20s and 30s, a few single females, and one pregnant woman is all we saw. So I know a lot of people worried about kids there and all that. There were no kids brought in there that we saw. So people are not sure of that. But my concern still on Saturday was, what's going to continue to happen? No one's reaching out to us. No one's talking to us. I was quite upset with the mayor because they did come on CTA buses, which is Chicago buses. They did not come from Texas like originally said. If you're upset, Mayor, talk to Governor Abbott. Governor Abbott has no clue where Elk Grove Village is. He has no clue Elk Grove Village exists, unless he watched the Bahamas Bowl. So that obviously did not happen. Then I was told, because I did ask very bluntly, I said, folks, you have a city of 3 million people, third largest city in the country, world destination, more hotels on one block than Elk Grove has in the entire community. Why aren't they staying there? True story, I was told, well, they have a marathon coming up. They have no room in the inn.
That's right. The marathon's less than a month away. You're right. Well, wait, so you had some strong words for Mayor Lightfoot, and she called you yesterday, and what happened during that conversation?
Yes, so that was all going on. So after we still were concerned things, I got a call from Mayor Lightfoot yesterday, and I commend her for that. She reached out to me, and mayors always have a bond. There's no rule with mayors. Mayors work with mayors. If the world was run by mayors working together, we'd have a great world because we understand what we go through, and we work locally. So she gave me a call, had a lengthy conversation, and explained to me that a lot of this is being dictated by the state of Illinois. She goes, Mayor, I don't have the authority to bring people to your town, which I agree with her on, and I realize that. So we talked, and we agreed, and she was humble. I give her a lot of credit, how she handled everything, and I'm very appreciative of that. And we agreed that starting this morning, her top staff people, my top staff people will be in conversation. We'll be talking through what's going to maybe happen in the future. They do have some plans in Chicago to address the people coming in, which they didn't have last week. And I leave it up to her to discuss what those are, but I'm very happy to hear that. But it may not all be all taken care of in Chicago, depending on how many come. So, again, we're more than welcoming, and we'll work with them. But you got to work with us. I know the mayor of Burr Ridge is frustrated. Work with the mayors. We've got great relationships, work together. And I think Mayor Lightfoot yesterday extended that reach to work together in the way it should be. And we kind of talked as mayors do, you know, what we all face and joked about that. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm very grateful that she took that she did. She expressed her, you know, apologies for, you know, anything that she may have been part of that was to our community. And she wants to work together. And I think that's great. So my hope was we worked this out. The good news is this. They've been here now for a couple days. We've had no issues. To their credit, the state police provided security to the area. They had civic organizations taking care of them, feeding them, and any needs they had. So at this point, there's been no strain in my community whatsoever. So my residents, we got the assurances that they're safe. We got assurances that others are helping cover the expenses that go with it and the security that needs to go with it. So to this point, it's gone well. So we'll work with Chicago. If we need to do it again, we'll be receptive to it. But this time, they're now treating us as equal. They're now working with us as partners and not just thrusting something onto us without any kind of support or knowledge.
Yeah.
And we're appreciative of that.
Humility, privately while she demagogues the issue publicly. But let me ask something. The La Quinta Inn, the location where I understand the migrants are staying. So how was that selected? Who's paying the freight for that?
Well, what happened was, and we talked to the owner. He was there Friday. And so I talked to him directly. I know the gentleman. I talked to him directly. What happened is, I guess we did not know this, but over the years, there's groups out there, you know, Catholic Charities, Red Cross, Salvation Army. Over the years, they have built up a rapport with hotels throughout the region. Not just Elk Grove, but in Chicago, other suburbs, I assume Burr Ridge also, worked out where things of situation rise, whether people came homeless for fires or other situations come in the community. And I guess homeless people and other things, they work out arrangements that they've had them housed in these places before. They're paid for by charitable organizations, like I said, Red Cross, Salvation Army, Catholic Charities. They do that. They send people out to help them. They send people out, give them food, give them assistance, clothing, whatever they
need. So it's various nonprofits, the Catholic Charities, Lutheran Services, et cetera, that's covered.
So they do all that. Okay. The one thing the state did step up on Friday is I told them, is every town around here is, we're short policemen. We can't find people to fill these jobs. So if anyone's listening, our starting pay is $86,000 a year. We have openings, apply to Elk Grove.
And we're more than happy to give you a chance, maybe police officer will go. But we're worried about that. So state police did step up. They contacted my police chief. They've been in communications. They worked with patrolling. So they have literally taken care of all the necessary things. So, but our main concern from the beginning was we weren't informed, and we're concerned about safety backgrounds and health backgrounds. We knew the people came from Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And, again, I have to protect my community's interests. Once we were assured of that and given the information, we're fine with it. And, again, I got to say, folks, I know there's a lot going on with Mayor Lightfoot getting upset, all these people upset, Mayor Governor Abbott and all that. These are still human beings.
Right, but you
and
said, too, that
to be treated as human beings.
Nobody disagrees with that. No. Nobody disagrees that everybody deserves to be treated with dignity and help people in need. And there's nobody who is has any antagonism towards Venezuelan migrants or Nicaraguan migrants. It's strictly about the sanctuary city and state policies that put a target on our back, like the one that Greg Abbott has now exploited. And to your point that you stated initially with her lame marathon excuse notwithstanding, yes, that if the city of Chicago can't handle a couple of busloads of migrants that have been shipped to us from the border, then maybe we should be rethinking our sanctuary city and state policies.
And Dan, you bring up a good point, and I even talked to the mayor about that.
What'd she say?
She was very caring and humble. I'm telling you, it's not what I see sometimes on TV. We had a great conversation, and I appreciate that. But I even said that to her. I said, Mayor, I understand your frustration, upset with governor, because they don't get much advance warning. These people come up here and all that. I said, you did the same thing, or the state, whoever was responsible, did the same thing to us. You didn't like it done to you.
Right.
How do you think we felt? And she said, to her credit, Mayor, that's why I'm talking to you.
Okay.
So to her credit, maybe us getting a little upset has changed how things are done. Now, as far as sanctuary cities go, I'm not involved. I don't want to get involved in that stuff. I'm not involved in that stuff. If they want to, God bless them. That's their choice. We're just here trying to run our community in a safe manner and make sure that everyone can function together. That's all I'm worried about.
Yeah,
that's
understand.
And Mayor,
you were there
when people got off the bus, and you said that there were awaiting cars, and some of them never even checked into La Quinta Hotel, that they went with family members or friends.
Right. What happened, and I kind of explained this too in our conversation, I said, we were out there Friday night, and when I went by there, born and raised in Elk Grove, I've known that hotel location forever, that parking lot was packed with cars, and they weren't all cars from Illinois, or Tennessee, Ohio, and Virginia we saw. Now, that could be people traveling, but they had people sitting there. So I had my chief of police go out and talk to the drivers and stuff, and they all said they're here to pick up people that are coming in, the migrants. They already had knowledge that they were there, are coming there, and they're there to pick them up. Hmm.
And
I told this to state officials, and they said, oh, yeah, that happens. We're fine with that. They said, remember, Mayor, they have legal status in America. Matter of fact, they actually have job visas. And in a way, that I'm kind of looking at it as maybe a good thing because, as you know, it's hard to get people to work nowadays. I've got hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs. You know, Elk Grove is the biggest business park in North America. I'd love to give them jobs. If they want jobs and they're legally able to take them, I'll give them jobs. We could help fulfill some shortfalls we have here. But, yeah, these people were sitting in the parking lot waiting for them to get there. And that's why I got really upset that night, is how did these people know that they were coming, we didn't know they were coming? And that's why my hope is now, though, we've gotten over that tough part. We're not going to work collaboratively the way mayors usually do, and I think we will, and we'll address the situation. Again, I don't mean to keep kicking the can down the road, but these are federal issues and stuff. I can't take care of that.
No, understood. We understand.
But I will work with them to solve the problem they have, and more importantly, help make sure we take care of people that need some help now. And I'd rather control what they're doing than just let them go willy-nilly, to be honest.
Yep. He is Craig Johnson. He's the mayor of Elk Grove Village. Craig, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and I both appreciate you covering everything.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This piece by Alexander Riley, The Forgetting of 9/11. Alexander Riley, writing in the AmericanMind.org. He is a sociology professor at Bucknell in Pennsylvania. We will, in these days around September 11th, read a good number of claims of how we must never forget. I know what some of these claims look like as I have made them myself. I spent a good deal of the 21 years since the attacks doing work to keep alive the memory of the heroes of that day. In fact, he wrote a book about Flight 93. Back to Riley. I regrettably admit that my faith in this project is extinguished. Most of America is already forgotten, and at least half of it remembers the day as a sign of American fallenness and failure. Here's one other recollection. This a little bit more ground level, from a New York City firefighter who's being fired for not being vaccinated. 21 years from this individual being described a hero, as he recounts.
Okay, I gave my best years to this city, 20 years from 21 to 41, and then they take it away at the peak of my earning career. I made it to captain. I went through that process. You should be ashamed of yourselves. You should be ashamed of yourselves. Eric Adams is going to be on the wrong side of history. The people who look by are the same people who thought slavery was okay. The same people who thought segregation in Shea Stadium was okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you segregated us. I was allowed to work in this city, but I wasn't allowed to eat in a restaurant in this city.
Thank you very much.
I was allowed to work through the pandemic, but I wasn't allowed to eat in a restaurant.
Okay.
I could wear the uniform, go to a burning building, but not eat here.
Thank you.
What's wrong with you people? Trust the science.
Thank
you guys are f***ed up.
Wow.
That's
some powerful stuff. And we still have vaccine mandates, guys, here in Chicago for police and firefighters.
Well, as the same thing is happening at the military, to the military families. You could hear somebody from the military make a similar claim to that New York City firefighter. Dakota Wood served America for 2 decades in the Marine Corps. He is the Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, blessing for me. Thanks for having me on. Good to be with you.
Alexander Riley, most of America has already forgotten 9/11. At least half of it remembers the day as a sign of American fallenness and failure. Can't say that he's wrong, can you?
Well, I read that article, and I think he makes a lot of really good points. I mean, as events recede in history, your personal connection to them, fade, right? So, I mean, I've got 3 kids, they're all in their 20s, but the oldest one was like 6 years old, when 9/11 happened. So today we find that 23% of Americans, so less than 1 out of 4, are even eligible for military service, and only 9% have any interest in joining the military. So this youth cohort, like 17 to 24-year-olds, really don't have a connection. They don't see the value of serving in the military. And these influences come from their parents, who were of age when 9/11 happened, various influencers in their lives, teachers, academics, those sorts of people. So I think that author really does make a compelling case that, yes, we have the memorial service, just like we remember Pearl Harbor and these sorts of things, but it just doesn't resonate with folks. And we see that and the allocation of monies for defense funding and the shrinkage and the aging of our military forces. So I don't know how we change that. Unfortunately, I think it has to be some kind of a catastrophic event that really shakes people out of the complacency.
And just speaking, borrowing from that New York City firefighter about people being effed up in terms of how firefighters and cops are being treated when it comes to COVID mandates. Same thing could be said of this story out of the Pentagon. The Pentagon is recommending U.S. soldiers struggling with soaring food prices apply for welfare. So now those men and women were properly supposed to mm-hmm. revere and were supposed to provide for. There's this promise, this contract that's made between civilians and military. Now we're telling them just, you know, go stand in line and get your government cheese.
Yeah, you know, there's not a requirement in most areas to get a flu vaccine to work in an office building or be part of the fire department or something like that. And yet we have, as you say, the reported people who are being kicked out of their jobs because they didn't get the COVID vaccine. And yet we have half a dozen senators and 24 or so Democratic members of the House who want to allow HIV-positive individuals to join the military. So, I mean, how do we reconcile this? You know, communicable through blood disease, and their argument is, well, there are ways to mitigate that, and there are pharmaceutical solutions to dealing with HIV/AIDS, and yet we can't apply the same rationale, you know, to the COVID issue. So, I mean, it's just the hypocrisy of supporting our military and yet not supporting it. Is almost obscene. And what we saw in President Biden's budget for this year was about a 40% increase in spending for all other departments on the federal side, right, the federal branch of government. And yet we saw about a 4% increase in defense spending. And meanwhile, we're dealing with, what, 8 or 9% inflation? So these poor, you know, families that are at the lower end, junior enlisted, they don't make much anyway. You make twice as much as a police officer or as a fire department firefighter, and you can make upwards of $70,000 or $80,000 driving a semi-trailer, you know, truck. So it just doesn't seem, going back to the original point, that our priorities really reflect what the rhetoric says. You know, the defending the country, keeping us, you know, free, safe, and prosperous. There's a huge gap between those two.
But did you ever think there would be a time where there'd be food insecurities for troops and their families?
Yeah, well, you know, inflation, right? The ravages of inflation. So, you know, if the price of a pound of beef or chicken, you know, has doubled in cost, and yet we're not increasing, you know, the availability of funding, you know, for our junior enlisted members in particular, you know, it's just ridiculous. And so it's the slow pace of the machine in Washington, D.C., the lack of a willingness to make an argument why we want to support folks that we would intentionally put in harm's way if they were called into service, you know, in time of war. And yet you have these young families, you know, many of them with children, trying to decide how to juggle their meager budget. So it surprises me. I, you know, 20 years in the Marine Corps, and I saw great small unit leadership, great support from Washington, you know, during my time from 85 to 2005. But it was a different period of American history.
Well, you know, look, we'll get around to the military families. Right now, we're sort of focused on King Charles's preparations for Queen Elizabeth's funeral.
Because our casket is moving right now. So we've got to be focused
on that. So, you know, we'll get around to you military guys and gals, but, you know, we got priorities. So, you know, just wait your turn there. I wanted to ask you something else, too, of national security and geopolitical matters. Both the border and Ukraine. Let's start with the border. We were talking about this a little bit last hour before you joined us with a local mayor here in Chicagoland. Now that migrant families have been visited upon Chicagoland per Greg Abbott and per what's happening at the border. But maybe we have it wrong because Kamala Harris, she's the vice president. She told Chuck Todd over the weekend that border secure.
Oof. Yeah, well, again, it's the rhetoric not matching reality. You know, it's a political narrative that they want to push forward that everything is okay. And yet we've got these border communities in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico that see tens of thousands of illegals. I mean, they're coming in illegally, coming across our borders, and somebody has to provide something. I mean, you know, medical care, food, potable water. There is a criminal aspect to some of these people coming over in terms of the flow of fentanyl and drug mules, human trafficking. I mean, it's just horrific conditions. But in Washington, D.C., they can say, nope, not a problem. Everything's secure and is going on. And I think it's a pretty incredible move on the part of the Texas governor to say, well, if you want to see what we're dealing with, here is a single busload. You know, here is 20 or 100 or 200 people. Meanwhile, we're dealing with tens of thousands, you know, down on our southern border. So it just doesn't pass the giggle test, right? I mean, you know, you hear these statements out of the Biden White House that don't have any bearing in reality. And what I've seen in the papers there in the Chicago area is people apoplectic that these buses are showing up. And then the mayor says, we don't want to deal with them here in the city, so we're going to move them again out to the suburbs, mm-hmm. right? Where we can kind of ignore the problem and put it on somebody else. So I don't know how they reconcile the reality that they're dealing with the rhetoric that they're saying, and everybody just sees through it. I just don't understand.
Well, they're saying the new thing is because we just got off the phone and we had the mayor of Elk Grove Village on. They told him that mm-hmm. since the upcoming Chicago Marathon will be here, all the hotels are going to be sold out and they need to push them into the suburbs.
Yeah.
Lies
yeah,
exactly. and more lies.
Okay. They're funny.
And the border's secure, but 5,000 to 6,000 are going to cross today alone.
Yeah, we got more fentanyl coming across our southern border to kill every man, woman, and child in the United States 100 times over. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And to hear what you just said about this rationale, we need hotel space. Well, what about the humanitarian aspect of taking care of these, you know, women and children
yeah.
That are showing up? They shouldn't be here to begin with. I get that, but they're physically here. So we either take care of them or we ship them back home.
But right? They gave them all work visas, at least the ones that went to Elk Grove Village, they did.
And they can get a driver's license in California, too. You know, public benefits that you and I are paying for.
Wanted to ask you about Ukraine, this counteroffensive by the Ukrainians mm-hmm. to retake Kharkiv. And if this is, as it's being breathlessly reported, a real turning point in the war to repel the Russians or a progress, yes, but we're still in it for the long haul.
Yeah, the first casualty is war is truth. So everybody wants to think that we're in the closing stages. I think we're still in the opening mm-hmm. Stages. That, you know, Russia still has more resources than Ukraine. Ukraine is only able to sustain operations because Western governments, like the United States, give them, you know, ammunition and vehicles and other types of weaponry. And just what a wonderful thing the Ukrainians are doing fighting for their homeland. So, yes, they do have this offensive going against the city in Kharkiv, which is the eastern part of the country. But it is way, way too early to know whether this is a last gasp, right? If it was supposedly a move to pin down Russian forces. The Russians have withdrawn, but a few analysts that I'm tracking say that they withdrew it because they recognize that the real offensive that will come is more toward the south, which endangers their land bridge to Crimea. And so it's a tactical repositioning of forces on the part of Russia, and we'll have to see what Ukraine is able to do with this moment. You know, they've suffered 3,000 and 4,000 casualties in previous offensives in other areas. So how long can they keep that going? And it's an open question at this point.
He is Dakota Wood. He served America for 2 decades in the Marine Corps. He is the Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the European Central Bank raised rates last week, and the mystics at the Fed said they're committed inflation fighters. You can expect, they didn't say this explicitly, but you can expect that 75 basis point increase on September 21st, maybe more even. That's how committed they are. So all is right with the world. Markets rebounded and everything's fine. Perhaps not. Joe Sternberg had a good piece in the Wall Street Journal last week about the coming global crisis, economic crisis, of climate policy. Lest you've forgotten, those same central banks I'm referring to and other regulators are in the middle of a major push to introduce various forms of climate stress testing into their oversight. They want to know how global temperature variations a century hence may weigh in on Citi's or Barclays or Deutsche Bank's capital and risk weightings today. He writes, the UK may be facing a wave of business bankruptcies exceeding anything witnessed during the post-2008 panic and recession. Some 100,000 firms could be forced into insolvency in the coming months, according to a bankruptcy consultancy. These are otherwise healthy firms with at least £1 million in annual revenue. Business failures on this scale would dwarf the roughly 65,000 firms of any size that won under from 08 to 10. The culprit? Energy prices, which this business bankruptcy consultancy believes could account directly for around 25% of the possible insolvencies. The prices are rising for British businesses in intervals of several 100% at a time, and sometimes with steep deposit requirements from utilities that fear precisely a wave of bankruptcies. Matters are even worse in Germany, he goes on to detail. And you've seen the sort of head-scratching policies being advanced in places like Spain, where you can't cool your home below 80 degrees with your air conditioning. In Switzerland, they're going the other way in preparation for energy shortages this winter. It has announced penalties, including the possibility of jail, for anyone who heats their home above 19 degrees Celsius, which 9 over 5 plus 32 is 66 degrees Fahrenheit.
Thank you for doing the math. Yes.
Heat your home over 66 and you get fined, and then you could go to prison in Switzerland. So you start to see what these observers are pointing us to take notice of. Yeah? For more on this, pleased to be joined by Christopher Whalen, investment banker, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC, author of Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, and editor of the Institutional Risk Analysis. Chris Whalen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Is that overstated? Are some of these observers hyperventilating, or do we have a real possibility that the dim-witted, apocalyptic climate policies that have been adopted by the corporate sector are going to bring about a real economic crisis?
Well, I think it's already happening. You know, the aspirational aspect of the whole climate change agenda is so far ahead of the technology that I think almost inevitably we're going to see problems. We're going to see problems in regions, for example, that have gotten rid of too much base generation capacity and they want to rely on quote-unquote renewables. And in the summertime, they won't have enough load, and the whole thing will come down. You know, electricity works or it doesn't. It's binary. There is no sort of. So if you can't maintain the network's load and also the frequency, which is how motors work, then the whole thing fails. And I think you could see that in some countries simply because they didn't think through how you do this. My friend John Dysart, by the way, who left the Financial Times recently, has got a new blog. And John is a keen energy analyst. He's been talking about this for a couple of years. So, yes. And the Russia-Ukraine war makes this much worse. It's going to bottom out the European economy in a way that's going to be quite frightening. Because we're talking about people not having food. You know, forget about cold in the winter for a moment. If you don't have enough fertilizer, then you're going to have severe privation in Europe next year. They just won't have any food.
So they won't let farmers use fertilizer in the Netherlands?
No, they need energy to make it, Amy.
Right, okay.
People, you know what I mean? You need natural gas to make fertilizer. Think of it that way. So you're going to have to divert natural gas supplies in Europe to make sure that farmers in England and Germany and Holland have fertilizer.
Well, this is in part the revolt that took hold earlier this summer in the Netherlands, was farmers not being allowed to, you know, be farmers.
Yeah. Well, if you look at California, you see the same idiocy with water. But when you overregulate any system, it starts to fail. You know, regulation is a form of restriction. It is an authoritarian tool of progressives. So by definition, whenever you have any regulation, it causes the system to slow down and die. Look at the Fed. The Fed has nationalized the Fed funds market, which used to be a private market. It doesn't exist anymore. And they're getting ready to nationalize the payment system with something called FedNow. Conservatives need to pay attention to this because Congress gave them no authority to spend these funds, to build these things. Who gave them authority to do this? You always have to remember one thing about the Fed, guys. It's an expense to the Treasury. People on the Hill like to pretend that the Fed gives them funny money, but it's not. It's an expense to the Treasury. So every dime they spend that they don't give back to the Treasury, the interest that the Fed earns on those Treasury bonds, is expenditure. And they need to be very carefully watched and overseen by Congress in this regard.
So expound on the implications of FedNow.
Well, it basically is going to push the banks and the clearinghouse out of the payments business, and it's going to give the Fed direct visibility into your checking account, into all the cash that comes and goes. So if you have the wrong politician in the White House, we're going to be living in China. In China, they use control of money to discipline political dissidents, to out people, to erase people. You just don't have any money anymore. They take it out of your account.
So
we'll give the government that capability.
So this prospect that was included in the first or second or 100th iteration of the Green New Deal, look into any transaction over $600, any balance over $10,000, all these different numbers that are being thrown around. But the principle was the government has direct access to your account. That's going to be done through the administrative state via the Fed, what couldn't get done through Congress legislatively.
Well, precisely. But remember something. The Fed is a New Deal progressive institution. When Congress made gold ownership illegal in the 30s, the Fed was helping the Treasury and the FBI track people down to get their gold before the law was even signed by Congress. Okay? Have no illusion which side of the table the Fed sits on. They are an institution that symbolizes authoritarian central control.
Hmm. Well,
it's our central bank version of Gauss Plan.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, you remember what the central and central bank means, right?
Correct. You don't see conservatives, you don't see our friends, guys, working at the Fed. They're not allowed. But there used to be little bastions of conservatism in Cleveland. You still have some very good people there, like Loretta Messer, for example, who I think would make a great chairman. Or chair, I guess we got to call them if they're girls, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, the description you gave before about the whole ecological mess, I think is profound. And look at Toyota. Look at how they resisted the EV madness with lithium batteries, okay, which is the issue, for a long time because they understand electricity in Japan. They're really good at this. And Toyota is a very cautious company. They don't commit themselves. And they were doing hybrids, which I think is the answer. If you live in the middle of the country, you need something with gasoline in the tank, right? Or it's not going to work, especially in cold weather. Forget about it. So I think, the bullshit and the hype has pushed our industrial sector into all sorts of things to meet the political demand, right? It has nothing to do with the economics or finance of electricity. I love electric cars. I would love to see us do this, but not with lithium batteries. We have to come up with another way to drive those motors. And then we have the division of Tesla and Edison and Ford. They wanted to do this 100 years ago, but they didn't have the technology. And they knew it. Edison told Ford, you'd use gasoline. Why? And the advances in gasoline engines, frankly, they are extraordinary. They're much more efficient, much cleaner, So if we use electricity intelligently in cities, for trains, things like that, where you can actually power them, but for trucks, no, not yet. We need a little gas turbine. That's what I keep waiting for from Elon Musk. Where is my little gas turbine, Mr. Musk?
Is he working on it?
250 Super Duty, right? I can use it.
I saw some urologist, though, was using his Rivian truck to provide the energy to perform vasectomies. So, I mean, it's not without utility. I saw that.
Well, they have great batteries. My point is, it's not for moving weight.
Right.
Okay? If you want to give people free electricity in cities, for their little cars, and they're going to make them smaller so they won't have range, because range requires battery. It requires weight, okay? So there's always that balance, that trade-off between range and the size of the vehicle. So I think you give away power in the cities and you let people charge at night, and you give them little EVs. That's great, but outside the city, we're not there yet. I don't think so.
So going back to our plucky little newly minted inflation busters like Jay Powell, what do you expect at the September 21st meeting? What do you expect? What should we expect to see with respect to inflation the rest of this year?
I think they're going to keep raising rates till the end of the year, and then I think that the Fed is going to pivot somewhat. They're going to leave the target rate for federal funds where it is, so figure it's 3 points higher than where we are now. And then they got to look at the balance sheet and see what happens as they let those funds roll off. Because when the Fed is no longer buying that Treasury bond, a private investor has to buy the bond. And that has implications for the banking system and other pieces of this puzzle that Jay Powell and the rest of the Board of Governors are trying to manage. This is called fine-tuning. You remember that term?
Yes.
Bad. Bad. No one can fine-tune. It's like flying a starship without eating enough spice in the film Dune, right? You need to eat the spice. So, you know, these people think that they can manage this very complex equation. And then I look at things like new issuance in the bond market and IPOs, and it's going into the floor. That's what I worry about. The market is clearly in distress, and the policies that we are seeing from the Fed are not helping. Now, who's happy? The banks. If people can't raise money in the bond market, they got to go call the bank. And so the banks actually are going to look better in the third quarter, guys. Even as the Wall Street crazies are running away from financials, I love this. I'm putting out my quarterly in a couple days. And the banks are actually looking better than they've looked in years. But all of the fair weather characters are off buying something else. I don't know where they are.
And as you know, demand is negatively impacted by rising rates, you expect that we'll see inflation continue to tick down? That's a question.
It'd be tough. If you look at the equation they use, the version of inflation that they use for policy, the housing component, whether it's rent or mortgage payments, is going to be really hard to get control of. Now, there are analysts who are, you know, predicting that we're going to see home prices fall off next year, you know, mid-single digits for 23-24. But I personally think anything below the average of around $300,000, that market is still so constrained in terms of, you know, supply and new home building that I can't see those prices coming off very much for at least a couple of years. So Fed's going to do what they're doing for at least another year, guys, all the way through next year, I think. And then if they start to get some glimmer of hope, then maybe they'll let rates fall a bit. But I think we've seen a reset in terms of where interest rates are going to be for a while, simply because the whole world is so chastened right now with inflation. It's a big problem.
And
we're going to see horrible politics around the country, around the world.
And so this green stagflation for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, and you describe Britain. I mean, imagine what's going to happen. Well, you don't have to imagine. You can see already small businesses shutting down across Europe because they look at the numbers coming in from their vendors for energy and other inputs for their business, and they just say, whoops, can't do this, you know. So I think that's already happening, and you'll see the headlines and the, you know, the debate over what to do. But the reality is Europeans allowed themselves to become dependent on the Russians, and we're going to have to help these businesses in the short term. We have to, because we're at war with these people. Look, I'm a quarter Ukrainian. My grandma's happy this morning because the Ukrainians are kicking the Russians' ass, and those soldiers who don't love Vladimir Putin are fleeing the same way they fled in World War I. It's fascinating. They're just giving up and running home. So I think we're on the verge of victory in Ukraine. If we hold together and we help the people of Europe get through this winter, I think we can reverse this situation and maybe get rid of Putin, which would be great.
Ever the optimist, Christopher Whalen, investment banker and chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC.
Have a great day, guys.
Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Lots of comments and reaction to this ad that I have produced and broadcast through the PAC that I run that's involved in the governor's race, as anybody who listens to this show knows. People who play by the rules PAC during the Bears game and elsewhere. There was the ad of the incident in Lakeview from a week ago Sunday that we talked about. You heard about it. Many of you saw it. The woman who was attacked in Lakeview but walking down the street Sunday afternoon by three men who jumped out of a car, robbed her, and then took off. And you hear her screams and pleas for help. I turned that into a television ad and getting a lot of reactions in both directions, I'm sure. Around town, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. If you've seen it, or if you've at least understand what the underlying incident was, the underlying criminal attack was, then whether or not it's right and proper to be included in the context of a political campaign to inform people's vote about what's actually happening in Chicago and Illinois.
Well, I think a lot of people who've been burying their head in the sand saw it for the first time yesterday because they watched the Bears game, the season opener, home opener, and they watched the Vikings-Packers game. And I was with a group of people, and they had never seen it before. And they said, what is that? I was with some liberals. And said, well, you know, we got to stop. We should to take guns off the streets. And I said, she wasn't shot. I mean, one guy brandished a gun, but they roughed her up, stole her fanny pack, her keys, her wallet, her cell phone, and just left her there. It was almost like they did it for sport. It was so sick. That's what, when I saw it, it was just like, oh, there's the lady, just jump out of a car, beat her up, get back in the SUV and pull away. But this isn't a gun issue. This is a violence issue in Chicago. And it got to the point where I was just like, you know what, I'm going home. And I just got up and left, because I didn't want to deal with it. But again, that's for the first time ever. So somebody contacted CWB, and you got into a Twitter skirmish or whatever you want to call it. They texted out, Proft has been asked to never use our site name or other property in any future ads. If his PAC does use it again, it will be with the full knowledge that we want nothing to do with any political activity. That would speak volumes about Dan Proft and his political candidates. And it just went on and on.
We did get in a Twitter fight because I didn't say anything publicly. I had a private back and forth with some anonymous representative from CWB Chicago that I just tried to explain to them something they don't seem to understand. And I like the site. We cite their work often here. That hyperventilation that you just read is just rank ignorance. I'm sorry they don't understand how this works. They should. They've been around for long enough. I assume these are journalists who have a bit of an understanding about how it works. Attribution is not endorsement. CW Chicago is immaterial to the ad, except as the cited source of the video that I used for the ad, because that's where I got it. So a news outlet, here's how it works for those who don't understand. If a news outlet's put something in the public domain, then there is fair use by something like a political campaign to use for non-commercial purposes with attribution, which is exactly what I did, which you see in political ads everywhere all the time. In fact, when you don't attribute the source when you're making a particular claim in the ad, that's when you get criticized as well. You also have problems getting the ad cleared by the stations to run if you can't substantiate claims that are being made in the ad. So I actually deal with executives at all these broadcast outfits, both radio, TV, or all radio, TV, digital. So I know how that works. And so the ads that are running, that ad that's running, that's causing so much consternation because of the woman's screams, that's what brings it home. The terror is what brings it home. I understand that perfectly. steps, and we'll get to that. But just to understand how the process works. So CW Chicago, their representatives are all anonymous. I don't know who they are. Don't particularly care. They just don't understand the law. I don't need to seek approval for them to use a video that they've put in the public domain as a outlet. In point of fact, they go on to say, we can't authorize the use of the video. It's Ring's video. Well, I don't need to seek Ring's approval, and I don't need to seek your approval, because however you got it, and you put it in the public domain. And then other people, including news stations, broadcast it. So all these news stations broadcast it. Mm-hmm. CWB Chicago posted it. It's flying around the internet when it was posted a week ago Sunday. But if I turn it into a ad that connects the dots to what it happened that day and what is happening in the city and the state and who's responsible, meaning Lightfoot and Pritzker, that's all of a sudden when it becomes a problem. It is not political in terms of bringing CWB Chicago or any other media outlet into this any more than when I cite AM 560 as the source for a Jim Glasgow quote that we've used in a previous ad. That's bringing AM 560 into the political campaign, made taking sides in the race, and it's not. So the part of it is this sort of separate legal issue that CWB Chicago just doesn't understand. And then there's the political part in terms of whether or not you think that's a fair and or effective message to deliver about the lawlessness that is endemic in Chicago.
And the reason why CWB got it, they got it from Chicago police, who have installed many Ring cameras and are using Ring cameras as a tool to catch criminals. They gave it to them saying, put that out there so we can see, does anybody know who these three guys are? We need information leading to an arrest. Happens all the time.
Whatever. Not my issue.
Well,
once a media outlet puts something in the public domain, mm-hmm. it is in the public domain for use for non-commercial purposes. I don't need, nor does the Pritzker campaign, nor does the Bailey campaign, nor does any other campaign, I don't need their permission to run something they have put in the public domain.
Well, these are the kinds of messages that CWB is receiving. Your political commercial showing a woman getting attacked and screaming is absolutely deplorable. I don't know what convinced you to have it play during the day, even during the Bears game. Now my children are traumatized and having nightmares. Okay, well, the Bears game played yesterday during the day, so she wrote this. Or they hadn't even gone to sleep yet. Whatever. It's disgusting. Stop airing that commercial. The ends do not justify the means.
Yeah, and I saw, it's probably the same person. I had an exchange with somebody that said basically the same thing, that she has this illusion that she can prevent her child from seeing her children from seeing violence in the world. I mean, they're inundated between TV and the internet and movies and video games and so. But okay, fine. Here's the point on that, and here's the point I would make to those who are offended by the broadcasting of something that was broadcast by news stations. And others, and shared on Twitter and other social media sites. It seems to me that you don't want to confront what is happening, mm-hmm. and you rather continue to rationalize things by listening to the beautiful lies from the very ugly liars than be forced to confront the disintegration of the city and the forthcoming disintegration of the state under the Safety Act. And that's your choice. You can rationalize, you can ignore, you can take the ostrich's posture, but my choice is to force people to confront what is. And unfortunately, that incident happened to that woman. And unfortunately, people in this city and state have not demonstrated particular adroitness in connecting the dots to the policymakers and specific policies responsible for horrific incidents like that. And so, you need to present things in stark fashion in order to generate the sort of conversation that leads to better outcomes. That's my view on it. People can disagree, but that's my view on it.
The woman who's worried about her kids having nightmares, 276 kids have been shot this year alone, 16 have died.
Well, this is this is my point. I mean, 200.
Are you kidding me?
We mentioned this yesterday. 250 children under the age of 17 have been murdered since Lightfoot and Pritzker took office, and you're worried about my spot being offensive. What you should find offensive, disgusting, depressing, intolerable is the systemic violence in Chicago and Cook County and coming to the rest of the state under the Safety Act, because you have representatives who've decided to fold in with predators rather than with the law abiding. That's what should have you up in arms. And so that's the argument I'm making. And if you don't like it, that's fine. You're entitled to not like it. But that doesn't mean I have to bury my head in the sand because you want to bury your head in the sand.
And also six carjackings yesterday and two more armed robberies reported so far.
Bill and Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, this commercial was playing while we were watching the Bears game at my local watering hole here in Elgin. And the sound, the deafening silence was throughout that bar. And everybody really paid attention to that commercial. And we all agreed that that was extremely powerful. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Thanks for the call, Bill. I was watching it at the bar in my neighborhood, the game, part of the game. And two ladies at the other end of the bar, when I saw the spot come up, watch it, it's quiet. Two ladies at the end of the bar after the spot played, one lady says to the other, "Whew, I wasn't expecting that." Right. That's how you get people's attention. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry it takes sort of a visual 2x4 to get the attention of half the electorate in this state and about 3/4 of it in the city, but that's the fact. And it's not an ends justify the means, because there's nothing illegitimate about the means. It's stark. It's sad. It's jarring. Yeah, well, that's a description of what's happening every day. Sad and jarring. So maybe we should decide as the law-abiding among us, maybe we should decide it's time to confront it head-on. That's my argument. I get to make arguments, and you get to make counter-arguments if you don't like it. Andy in Hinsdale.
Yeah, I have a business in the near west side, not Garfield Park. This is just west of the West Loop, Tony West Loop. Two armed attempted robberies in August, one of which was prevented because several of my employees, including myself, are all concealed carriers. And my one employee approached the car with four hooded guys with guns, and he walked up to the car, and they quickly jumped in back in the car, sped out of our establishment. Second one, because we are now keeping all of the doors locked and having to buzz people in. Okay, I don't really care about this woman's child having nightmares, because this woman and all these people who have voted for this crap are imposing a nightmare on everyone who is living in Chicago. And Pritzker and Lightfoot and David Brown and all these newspapers wouldn't have come out and talk to me, someone who's living this reality, who actually living in the real world, not this fantasy world that they live in. Now I have an employee who is so afraid to come to work, and she lives in the city. She's been working in the city for 20 years, right? I've been in this city longer than any of these clowns, Pritzker, Lightfoot, Kim Fox, and I am sick and tired of it. And what they're doing with all that, they want guns off the streets. They are forcing normal people to arm themselves. They're turning us into an armed populace. So make no mistake about what's going on.
Thanks for the call, Andy. Appreciate it. You know, would it have been better? I mean, did you see the video that went viral last week at West Garfield Park? Some guy in line at a retail store sucker punches another guy from behind. The guy from behind gets up, turns around as he's going out the revolving door and puts two in his chest and kills him. And you see it. You see the video. You see that he's writhing on the ground, that he's got, you know, he's bleeding profusely, and then he turns over and he's basically done. I mean, is that what should I do? What should we do about that? You know, what the children and their virgin eyes can't see these things.
Children are pretty.
Or instead, should we say, I am not going to tolerate living in a city and a state where these things are ubiquitous. And nobody seems particularly concerned about doing anything about them other than playing the race card and deflecting attention away from the substance of the issue, as Andy was talking about with his businesses. I mean, is this going to be a city and state for predators or for the law abiding? It seems to me that's the question. And you would think that the answer is easy, but it doesn't appear that it is. And I'm not just talking about for the politicians in charge, but as Andy said, for the people who put them there. It seems like they're struggling with that choice. For the law abiding or for the predators?
We had a 15-year-old shot this weekend, a 17-year-old shot this weekend, a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old who was shot in the face.
The kid that was killed by Kenwood Academy in Hyde Park.
That was Friday.
And you had Stacey Davis Gates, the head of CPSO. Here we go again, having to bury another child. Stacey Davis Gates, the Chicago Teachers Union, the defund the police, deprosecute.
Venezuelan tours.
You're for defunding the police and for not prosecuting repeat violent offenders. And you're going to give me this here we go again? Yeah, here we go again at the hands of Stacey Davis Gates and the Chicago Teachers Union and the politicians they own and operate that they put into office in the city and the county and the state. It's the same group. So if you're supporting that group, then you're supporting what you're seeing on the streets, and it's not just my television spot or that one incident in Lakeview. And you can rationalize it all you want. Oh, protect the kids and their delicate sensibilities. I don't like the racial composition of the incident you're presenting or the person you're profiling. And so profiling in terms of the news, in terms of giving them profile so you understand what's happening. This is an example of the kind of violent repeat criminal predator that continues to prey on people at the hands of our justice system. I mean, pick a side. Just answer that question straight away and spare me all of the moralizing and the histrionics. Melissa, Naperville.
I live in Naperville, actually about four blocks from Ann Stava Murray. And if you go on these Facebook pages this weekend, somebody posted information about the Safety Act. And literally just an onslaught of, oh, this is political, this is political. And to be honest with you, a lot of these people have no clue what's going on in Chicago. What they hear about are very affluent people moving out here because they want to escape the violence. And particularly for the females, mothers out here, you know, like you said, they want to turn a blind eye and they don't want to wrap their arms around the idea that this can come to their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And obviously it has started in Naperville. But, you know, a huge part of this is just people wanting to turn a blind eye and not realizing the trickle-down effect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And this is political. This is political. It was legislation signed by the governor. Of course it's political. Everything's political. This is Chicago. This is Illinois. It's political. What does that even mean? Yes, it's political because it involves politicians making public policy choices. That's called politics, you nitwits. That's just a cover. I'm above politics. No, you're not. You don't even know what you're talking about. Oh, it's just politics. I don't pay attention to that because that's not important. Public safety is about politics. And politics informs public safety, whether you have it or not. Your kids' education, politics. It informs the kind of schools you have access to or don't. Oh, that's just politics. I love that throwaway phrase. That means I'm a mope, but I don't want you to know. I don't know anything, but I don't want you to know, so I'm just going to pretend I'm above the fray. You need to get into the fray. Danny, Northside.
Yeah, I find it interesting, as Amy was referencing her friends who wanted to protect their delicate children's sensibilities from seeing a mugging, that they will make their PB&Js, pat them on the head, and send them off to school where they're going to be told that the world is burning and we'll all be dead by 2050. So, you know, that's not a problem.
Climate change. Yeah,
the children. Real problem. Thanks for the call, Danny. Mike, Northwest Indiana.
Hey, morning. Dan, that's the best spot I've seen in years.
that just literally, like you said, hit him in the forehead with a 2x4. But I'll tell you what, our own family's experienced police officer coming to the door at night with news that a loved one's been murdered. So you think that's not getting hit with a 4x4 and then hitting the gut with it also. And that's for the rest of your life. So I have absolutely no compassion for people that think like that. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
Her kids hadn't even gone to bed yet. It's like they're having nightmares. They just saw it during the Bears game.
I mean, 500 people murdered, 2,500 people shot. So much of this preventable year after year after year. Now you want to take that and you want to make that statewide law to help Chicago export its political culture and push its problems on the suburbs, which it always does. That's the whole play here. The Safety Act is like the sanctuary city, then sanctuary county, then sanctuary state. Take our political culture and our problems and make them everybody else's. And the suburbs better wake the frack up.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we get to our next guest, I think one of her potential future constituents, Tina and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. I want to share a real quick story with you. Yesterday, I was at my local Sherwin-Williams buying paint for a property I'm trying to sell right away so I can get the hell out of Illinois. And in walks this black men, one older gentleman and two younger, covered in paint, obviously busting their butts this weekend, working hard. And we strike up conversation talking about the price of paint and how everything's outrageous. And the older gentleman and I are just, bantering back and forth, totally agree with each other. And I said, well, you remember that in November when you go to vote? And he goes, oh, I will. We got to vote JB out. That guy has got to go. I said, you got that right. Have you heard about the Safety Act, which kicks in January 1? No, he hadn't. So I start rattling off all the potential, the crimes that will no longer require bail. And he's flabbergasted, has no information on it, never heard of it prior. And behind the counter comes the 85-pound white dude with the nose ring to tell me they can still be detained. And the older black man looks him in the face and says, young man, let the grown-ups talk. Shut him down. In a heartbeat. It was spectacular.
Well,
everybody is sick and tired.
That's great. That's a great story. Thanks, Tina. Well, I even like that the 32-year-old with the nose ring, the skinny white dude, was engaged enough to repeat the left's talking point that they can still be detained. And then we could go into more. But that means that everybody's talking about it and everybody's trying to get their arguments in order. And of course, they can be detained. I like the black gentleman's, the adults are talking, go back behind the counter. That's good. But also they can be detained. Right. That's not how it actually works in the real world. Bias is against detention in the legislation. Thus the carve out for these classes of crimes. That's number one. And remember the other thing that is not talked about enough. In order to detain, you have to show that they pose a specific threat to public safety. In other words, you can't say Dan burned down Amy's house and we're afraid if he's bonded out that he's going to go burn down somebody else's house. Oh, no, no. You can't say Dan is a pyromaniac and an arsonist and we feel like he's going to indiscriminately burn down people's houses. No, no. You have to have proof. Or likelihood that Dan is going to burn down Mike Scott's house next, and that we that he's targeting Mike Scott's house. That's the only way you get me detained. So this, they can still be detained. That's the mantra of somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about, has not talked to county prosecutors, has not talked to judges, has not talked to county sheriffs, has not talked to anybody in the law enforcement system on that side of it, the prosecution and detention side of it, that and adjudication side of it, that actually understands how this works in practice when you're dealing with mountains of cases on a daily basis.
And the kids are starting to know. My, you know, youngest son, he was came to me yesterday and he said, "Is this true?" And he was on Instagram, and all of his friends, they're all spreading it on Snapchat and Instagram. And I sat him down and explained exactly what it was. We talked for about a half hour. It was so kids know. So when your kids ask you about it, take time out of your day, please, to just sit with them and walk them through it so they know.
Yeah, or the example that, just on that, another example, just to make this concrete, since it's not legalese, I think it was either Glasgow or Berlin used it when we talked to them about this. By the way, Glasgow is a Democrat for Axios, for Monica Ng at Axios. It's funny, she's reporting on alleged misinformation associated with me. She can't cite any misinformation or quote-unquote fake news, but she includes fake news in her report on it. Monica Ng, a Republican county prosecutor, said it will be the end of days. No, that quote is attributed to James Glasgow, who's actually a Democrat county prosecutor. But I understand Monica and Axios and the rest of the Chicago press corps. I understand why know what you're talking about. Why so fact check when your only purpose is to amplify the messages of your fellow travelers politically. I get it.
That's but infuriating. That's that is such do. An easy fact check.
But the other example that was provided by one of the prosecutors was I attempt to kill my wife. And I'm being arraigned on it. And you say, well, the state's attorney says, well, or assistant state's attorney says, well, we'd like to hold Mr. Proft over because we feel he's a threat to the public. Well, who am I a threat to? I attempted to kill my wife. I didn't kill her, so I'm only a threat to my wife. So if I had killed her, I would no longer be a threat to my wife or anybody else. If my wife is still around, then I'm a threat to my wife, and that's a certain. I mean, in other words, it's upside down in terms of the incentives presented for the severity of crime. All right. For more on all things related to suburban living in Chicago, pleased to be joined by Catalina Lauf. She's the Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois 11. That seat currently held by Bill Foster. So this is West and Southwest Burbs. CatalinaForCongress.com is her website. Catalina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan and Amy.
I know this is mostly a state and local issue, but seems like everybody is getting pulled in, and rightly so, getting pulled into the discussion about public safety.
You know, it's not a state and local issue, and that is what gets me so frustrated with people who are currently in office, elected officials, who have a platform, they have a voice, and their job is to educate their constituents on something like this in particular. Tina brings up a really good point about how the biggest issue is that, especially when I'm on the ground talking with constituents all the time, or future constituents, is they don't know what's going on because these things are hidden so much, either by the media. It's not only just safety. Think about what's going on in our schools. You know, these people, they don't hear the truth. And then you have the other side who is blatantly lying over what is actually in these bills and the reality of it. And so, as you know, anytime you have a platform or you are an elected official, it is your job to educate your constituents. It doesn't matter if it's local, state. You have a reason and a real opportunity to be a servant leader and talk about these things on the ground. And the majority of our elected officials don't do that on both sides of the aisle.
Well, then what do you suggest? I mean, what do you suggest to try and stop this safety bill from going through? Even though I know you're applying for a district-wide seat, but what are you hearing from your constituents and what are your suggestions?
The biggest thing is, first of all, educate, right? If you have the opportunity to talk to your neighbors, Amy, you mentioned you spoke with your son. I'm not sure if he's voting age. We have to make sure that people fundamentally know what is in this and how dangerous it is to our community. I've done what I can with, emailing the people that we know and really causing a buzz about these things, because 9 out of 10 times, think about what happened with the graduated income tax initiative. You know, something like that lost districts by upwards of 20 points because people understood what it was and they were able to vote against it. It all comes down to voting against the people who are trying to push this. This is our state. This is our country. If we don't like what our elected officials are presenting to us and pushing towards us, then we have the ability to stop it. It really takes, it's the power of the people. When we band together, we're able to destroy legislation like this that is completely horrible for our state. And honestly, it will impact other states as well. I mean, the crime is through the roof. I talk to people, you have carjackings happening in Naperville that was never happening before. DuPage County, Kane County, up to McHenry County, we're seeing the growing crime rates. If you don't think a bill like this will continue to destroy our communities, then you are far off. And I think the majority of people, Republican and Democrat and Independents, would greatly oppose this if they knew exactly what was in it.
And so as a member of Congress, potentially, then your focus when it comes to trying to aid the communities in which you would be representing would be on resources to be able to hire more police? Would it be on pushing the federal law enforcement to work more closely with local law enforcement outside of Chicago and in the suburbs? What would it be?
Absolutely. You know, you need a commitment from your elected officials. If something like this does pass, and it's sad that it has gotten to that point where, you know, we cannot rely on our state elected to protect our communities, the burden does fall on the federal level. And that is a commitment that you have to have from your elected officials on the federal level once things at the state are completely destroyed. But it's not just that. You know, there is an information gap. There is a leadership component that we have not seen. Think about all of the riots that happened in 2020. You know, our suburbs, our sleepy suburbs, were destroyed, and you didn't have a single, very little, I'm sorry, I won't say a single because there were a few. You had few elected officials on either side of the aisle speaking out who did not have the courage to speak out against this. And the growing crime rate. And it's very sad. You know, I talk to our law enforcement community. You have retirements upwards of 200%. The academy classes are the smallest they've ever been. And at what point do we say enough is enough and do our job here? And right? It's getting worse.
And a related issue, I guess I should say, is, and that's now been visited upon Chicagoland, is border security. Kamala Harris said yesterday on Meet the Press, the border is secure, border communities and states and increasingly the rest of the nation know that's not true. What is your sort of mind's eye to border security and how much of a priority will that be for you as a member of Congress?
It has to be one of the top priorities. You know, my family came here legally from Central America. It is second generation Latin American and people who have come here the right way, who understand the need for safety and security at our border, for resources at our border. You know, I speak with candidates and even local people down by the border, and they talk about how this administration has fundamentally, it's almost nefarious how it's not just incompetence at this point, where they're fundamentally not putting resources down there. They are doing this on purpose. You know, this administration campaigned on incentivizing people to come here illegally. Now, we now see upwards of 200,000 illegals coming over across the border, and everybody is silent. This administration is completely silent. And the amount of labor, drug, sex trafficking that's happening is again, increasing year after year, month after month, frankly. And what are our elected officials doing?
What is Bill Foster had to say about any of this?
Oh, good question.
Well, he's doing the Biden hiding in the basement strategy, which is not speaking at all. And he's actually refused to debate as well. And so these far left Democrats who have voted 100% with Nancy Pelosi, further than AOC even, now have a record to run on because of the chaos that's happening in our country. And, you know, they think that by just ignoring it or even lying about it, that's somehow going to get them reelected. But that's not what's going to happen this time. You know, people are fed up with everything that's going on. They're fed up with the chaos. They just want to be left alone. They want more money in their pockets. They want to be able to find baby formula that we still have a shortage in this district, by the way. I was just at Walgreens down in Naperville, and there's still a baby formula shortage. All of these issues are going to pile up in November because people are sick and tired of this administration and fundamentally not doing its job.
She is Catalina Lauf, Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois' 11 West and Southwest Burbs. For more information on her candidacy campaign, get involved. CatalinaForCongress.com. Catalina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.